WGXC is a listener-supported community radio station, and it is also a new platform for presenting innovative experimental works on the air. Tune in, WGXC 90.7 FM, Agra, Hudson, Catskill, and points beyond. Listen to special programs of performance, words, sounds, and other rare and delicious items. Transmitting the arts all day every Saturday and weekdays after midnight. Here is there. Radio lives on in our minds and
hearts. You are listening to Human Machine, a program that airs each Saturday on WGXC 90.7 FM. Research in various scientific fields examine a speculative next stage in human evolution. Many predict an imminent human transformation based on increasing computer processing speed and manufacture, which will merge technological and human architectures. In this series, we will present projects and research about the horizons of the human machine. The program alternates weekly between Jeremy Kelly's curation of machine systems influence composers and Maximilian Goldfarb's assembly of materials that depict the convergence of humans and technology. Episodes will be thematically arranged to cover topics such as autonomous vehicles, medicine, sexual relations, space and habitation, nanotechnology, slavery, warfare, labor, bioresearch, prosthetics and agriculture, all areas examined in relation to our subject of human-machine advancement.
Pavlov, after all, made some extremely profound observations, both on animals and on human beings. And he found, among other things, that conditioning techniques applied to animals or humans in a state either of psychological or physical stress sank in, so to say, very deeply into the mind-body of the creature, and were extremely difficult to get rid of, that they seem to be embedded more deeply than other forms of conditioning. And this, of course, this fact, I think, was discovered empirically in the past. People did make use of many of these techniques. But the difference between the old empirical intuitive methods and our own methods is the difference between a sort of hit-and-miss craftsman's point of view and the genuinely scientific point of view. I mean, I think there is a real difference between ourselves and, say, the inquisitors of the 16th century. We know much more precisely what we are doing than they knew, and we can extend, because of our theoretical knowledge, we can extend what we are doing over a wider area with a greater assurance of producing something which really works. In this context, I would like to mention the extremely interesting chapters in Dr. William Sargent's Battle for the Mind, where he points out how intuitively some of the great religious teachers, leaders of the past, hit on the Pavlovian method. He speaks specifically of Wesley's method of producing conversions, which were essentially based upon a technique of heightening psychological stress to the limit by talking about hellfire, and so making people extremely vulnerable to suggestion, and then suddenly releasing this stress by offering hopes of heaven. And this is a very interesting chapter, showing how how completely, on purely intuitive and empirical grounds, a skilled natural psychologist, as Wesley was, could discover these Pavlovian methods. Well, as I say, we now know the reason why these techniques worked, and there is no doubt at all that we can, if we want to, carry them much further than was possible in the past. And of course, in the recent history of brainwashing, both as applied to prisoners of war and to the lower personnel within the Communist Party in China, we see that the Pavlovian methods have been applied systematically and with extraordinary efficacy. I mean, I think there can be no doubt that by the application of these methods, a very large army of totally devoted people has been created. The conditioning has been driven in, so to say, by a kind of psychological iontophoresis, into the very depth of the people's being, and has got so deep that it's very difficult for it ever to be rooted out. And these methods, I think, are a real refinement on the older methods of terror, because they combine methods of terror with methods of acceptance, method that the person who he is subjected to a form of terroristic stress, but for the purpose of inducing a kind of voluntary, quotes, acceptance of the state and the psychological state into which he has been driven, and the state of affairs within which he finds himself. So that, as I say, there has been, I think, a definite improvement, shall we say, in the techniques of terrorism. But then we come to consideration of other techniques, of non-terroristic techniques for inducing consent and for inducing people to love their servitude. Here, I mean, I think we can, I don't think I can possibly go into all of them because I don't know all of them, but I mean, I can mention a few of the more obvious methods which can now be used and which are based upon recent scientific findings. First of all, there are the methods connected with straight suggestion and hypnosis. I think we know much more about this subject than was known in the past. People, of course, have always known about suggestion, and although they didn't know the word hypnosis, they certainly practiced it in various ways. But we have, I think, a much greater knowledge of the subject than in the past, and we can make use of our knowledge in ways which I think the past was probably never able to make use of it. For example, one of the things we now know for certain is that there is, of course, an enormous, I mean, this has been always known, a very great difference between individuals in regard to their suggestibility. But we now, I think, know pretty clearly the sort of statistical structure of a population in regard to its suggestibility. It's very interesting when you look at the findings in different fields. I mean, in the field of hypnosis, in the field of administering placebos, for example, in the field of general suggestion in states of drowsiness or of light sleep, you will find the same sorts of orders of magnitude continually cropping up. You will find, for example, that the experienced hypnotists will tell one that the percentage of people who can be hypnotized with the utmost facility, just like that, is about 20%. That about a corresponding number at the other end of the scale are very, very difficult or almost impossible to hypnotize, and that in between there lies a large mass of people who can, with more or less difficulty be hypnotized, they can gradually be, if you work hard enough at it, be got into the hypnotic state.
The experiment you'll be taking part in today involves the perception of lengths of lines. As you can see here, I have a number of cards, and on each card there are several lines. Your task is a very simple one. You're to look at the line on the left and determine which of the three lines on the right is equal to it in length. All right, we'll proceed in this order. You'll give your answer.
Only one of the people in the group is a real subject, the fifth person with the white t-shirt. The others are confederates of the experimenter and have been told to give wrong answers on some of the trials. The experiment begins uneventfully as subjects give their judgments.
Two.
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 Three.
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 But on the third trial, something happens.
Two.
Two.
Two. Two.
The subject denies the evidence of his own eyes and yields to group influence.
One.
Ash found subjects went along with the group on 37% of the critical trials. But he found, through interviews, that they went along with the group for different reasons.
One.
One.
They must be right. There are four of them and one of me.
One.
This subject's yielding is based on a distortion of his judgment. He genuinely believes that the group is correct.
One.
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 Two.
One.
Two.
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 I know they're wrong, but why should I make waves?
Two.
In this case, the subject knows he is right, but goes along to avoid the discomfort of disagreeing with the group. Here, the distortion is at the level of his response.
Two.
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 In the previous experiment, the naive subject stood alone against the group. In this variation, Ash gave the naive subject a partner, here seated in the third position, who also gives the correct response.
One.
One.
Two. One.
Two.
With a partner, yielding drops to only 5% of the critical trials compared to 37% without a partner. Although subjects report warmth and good feeling toward the partner, they typically deny that he played a role in their own independence.
Two.
The partnership variation shows that much of the power of the group came not merely from its numbers, but from the unanimity of its opposition. When that unanimity is punctured, the group's power is greatly reduced. Sometimes we go along with a group because what they say convinces us they are right. This is called informational conformity. But sometimes we conform because we are apprehensive that the group will disapprove if we are deviant. This is called normative conformity. The strength of the normative factor is shown in another variation carried out by Ash. In this variation, the subject is told that because he had arrived late, he would have to write his answers. Subjects in this private response experiment are exposed to the same amount of misleading information as other subjects, but they are immune from any possible criticism by the group.
One.
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 And this enormously reduces the pressure to conform. Conformity drops by 2/3. Ash's experiment is a classic. It reveals how people will deny what they see and submit to group pressure. It allows us not only to observe conformity, but to study the conditions that increase or reduce its occurrence.
Thank you. Can pigeons read? This one gives every indication, because he's been taught to distinguish between two words and to behave appropriately. He's learned his different response to each sign by being rewarded with food. So the bird isn't acting independently. Its behavior is shaped by controlling its environment. The first task was to isolate an individual piece of behavior and see how that could be changed. Skinner did this by keeping individual pigeons at about 3/4 of their normal weight, so that the birds were always hungry, and food could be used as an automatic reward. The pigeon was studied in a uniform box, one it quickly grew used to. One piece of behavior, pecking a colored disc, was measured on a graph. The pigeon learned that pecking the disc produced a reward. Then the behavior of pecking could be studied in relation to how often that reward was offered. Or in Skinner's terms, what was the schedule of reinforcement?
The main thing is what we call schedules of reinforcement. Reinforcement is what the layman calls reward, and you can schedule it so that a reward occurs every now and then when a pigeon does something. We usually use a response with a pigeon pecking a little disc, a little spot on the wall, and you can reinforce with food. But you don't reinforce every time, perhaps every tenth time, or perhaps only once every minute or something like that. There are a very large number of schedules, and they have their special effects. And there is a good example of how you can move from the pigeon to the human case, because one of the schedules which is very effective with rats or pigeons is what we call a variable ratio schedule, and that is at the heart of all gambling devices and has the same effect. A pigeon can become a pathological gambler just as a person can. Now, the fact that we found that out with pigeons and could prove it by removing and changing the schedule makes it easy for us to interpret the case with the human subject. We don't say that the human subject gambles to punish himself, as the Freudians might say, or gambles because he feels excited when he does so. Nothing of the sort. People gamble because of the schedule of the reinforcement that follows. And this is true of all gambling systems. They all have variable ratios built into them. So what we've learned from the pigeon, it made it possible to interpret this vast field very effectively.
Where does that leave free will? Because we all think we have a choice of whether to do things or not to do things.
Yes. Well, you see, it leaves it in the position of a fiction. We have assumed somehow or other that these internal states, feelings, and so on, have initiated something. They have started something. They have created. We have done something in a voluntary way. We have will to act. If you now look at the actual history, we find that there are external reasons why this has happened. In other words, by discovering the causes of behavior, we can dispose of the imagined internal cause. We dispose of free will as an American divine of the 18th century, Jonathan Edwards, did. He said, we believe in free will because we know about our behavior, but not about its causes. And of course, it's the object of a science of behavior to discover causes. And once you have found those causes, there is less you need to attribute to an internal act of will, and eventually, I think, you need to attribute nothing to it.
The feature of machine teaching is that each student follows a carefully constructed program, leading from the initial stage where he is wholly unfamiliar with the subject to a final stage in which he is competent. He does this by taking a large number of very small steps arranged in a coherent order. Each step is so small that he is almost certain to take it correctly. The material is designed to give the student as much help as possible. He is not in any sense being tested. Instead, helpful hints, suggestions, and prompts maximize the chances that he will be right. The fact that each step is very small is important. Even though it may not seem like much of an accomplishment, it is always progress in the right direction. Programs have been constructed in which, without any prior study, the average student is right 95% of the time. This result is partly due to the fact that the student only moves on when he has completely mastered all the preceding material. If he is absent, he does not miss any work because he takes up where he left off upon returning to the machine. A conservative estimate seems to be that with these machines, the average grade or high school student can cover about twice as much material with the same amount of time and effort as with traditional classroom techniques. There is no magic about this. A teaching machine is simply a convenient way of bringing the student into contact with the man who writes the program. It is the author of the program, not the machines, who teaches. He stands in the same position as a textbook writer, except that he is much closer to the student. He and the student are constantly interacting. This interaction can be mediated in different ways, of course, and each way means a different kind of teaching machine, each having special features and advantages.
While some scientists engineer shiny new consumer goods for an eager public, Harvard psychologist B.F. Skinner seeks nothing less than the engineering of human nature. In experiments with subjects as simple as pigeons, Skinner declares that with the right social engineering, we can create a new breed of human being.
What is there in human nature that allows an individual to act without any restraints whatsoever, so that he can act inhumanely, harshly, severely, and in no way limited by feelings of compassion or conscience? These are questions.
But he might be dead in there.
The experiment requires that you continue.
330 volts.
The experiments that Milgram and others conducted were controversial, and for ethical reasons may never be conducted again. Yet the results of those experiments remain groundbreaking, profoundly revealing about the tensions between the individual and society, and increasingly relevant to contemporary life. In 1962, Stanley Milgram shocked the world with his study on obedience. To test his theories, he invented an experiment that would become a window into human cruelty. In ascending order, a row of buttons marked the amount of voltage one person would inflict upon another. Milgram's original motive for the experiment was to understand the unthinkable. How the German people could permit the extermination of the Jews.
When I learn of incidents such as the massacre of millions of men, women, and children perpetrated by the Nazis in World War II, how is it possible, I ask myself, that ordinary people, while courteous and decent in everyday life, can act callously, inhumanely, without any limitations of conscience? Now, there are some studies in my discipline, social psychology, that seem to provide a clue to this question. The problem I wanted to study was a little different, went a little bit further. It was the issue of authority. Under what conditions would a person obey authority who commanded actions that went against conscience? These are exactly the questions that I wanted to investigate at Yale University.
It is May 1962. An experiment is being conducted in the Elegant Interaction Laboratory at Yale University. The subjects are 40 males between the ages of 20 and 50 residing in the greater New Haven area.
Psychologists have developed several theories to explain how people learn. One theory is that people learn things correctly whenever they get punished for making a mistake.
40 years later, Milgram's infamous experiment, Obedience, is still taught in classrooms around the world.
Would you open those and tell me which of you is which, please? Teacher. All right, now the next thing we'll have to do is set the learner up so that he can get some sort of punishment.
What inspired Milgram, I would say there were a number of factors. One of them is he was very ambitious. He wanted to make a mark in social psychology. And he wanted, as he wrote to one friend, he wanted to come up with the boldest experiment that he could think of.
Would you roll up your right sleeve, please? This electrode is connected to the shock generator in the next room. And this electrode paste is to provide a good contact to avoid any blister or burn.
The victim was an accomplice of the experiment. The victim, according to plan, provided many wrong answers. His verbal responses were standardized on tape, and each protest was coordinated to a particular voltage level on the shock generator.
Now, as teacher, you were seated in front of this impressive-looking instrument, the shock generator. Its essential feature is a line of switches that goes from 15 volts to 450 volts, and a set of verbal designations that goes from slight shock to moderate shock, strong shock, very strong shock, intense shock, extreme intensity shock, and finally XXX, danger severe shock. Your job, the experimenter explains to you, a word pair test. If he gets each answer correctly, fine, you move on to the next pair. But if he makes a mistake, you are instructed to give him an electric shock, starting with 15 volts, and you increase the shock one step on each error.
Incorrect. You'll now get a shock of 105. Just how far can you go in this thing?
As far as is necessary.
What do you mean, as far as is necessary?
Milgram was very much aware that obedience is a necessary ingredient for society to function. But he focused on the darker side of obedience.
Incorrect. 150 volts. Sad face.
It's absolutely essential that you continue. You have no other choice, teacher.
Oh, I had a lot of choices. My number one choice is that I wouldn't go on if I thought he was being harmed.
Now, this man makes disobedience seem a very rational and simple deed. Now, other subjects respond quite differently to the experimenter's authority.
Wrong. It's hair. 75 volts, Jim. You don't know.
Please continue. Some psychologists were troubled by the ethics of it. Many, if not most, subjects found it a highly stressful, conflicted experience. People are stammering, stuttering, laughing hysterically and appropriately.
150 volts.
Here, let me out.
Continue, please.
Let me out there. My eyes bother me. Let me out.
Clearly, you know, when we say people went to the top of the shock board, it wasn't like they were going blithely, sadistically. People went stop and go, stop and go. They were in a state of conflict, which was created a tremendous amount of stress. So that was the main critique.
This will be at 3:30.
In 1971, in the basement of the psychology department of Stanford University, a mock prison was created. It rivaled all social psychology experiments in controversy.
Shortly after I finished this Stanford prison study, Milgram embraced me and said, "I'm so happy that you did this." He said, "Because now you can take off some of the heat that he's had to bear alone of having done the most unethical study."
Although this experiment is over 30 years old, its enduring power has been underscored by the events at Abu Ghraib.
When we got to Abu Ghraib, it was eerie. People were being told to rough up Iraqis that wouldn't cooperate. I mean, they're torturing, they're abusing detainees. You're looking at the situation thinking, they've condoned this, but why? And if it wouldn't have been for those photos, no one would have ever believed what was going on over there.
When I first saw the pictures, immediately a sense of familiarity struck me, because I knew that I had been there before. I'd been in this type of situation. I knew what was going on in my mind.
The photographs were strikingly familiar to the photographs that we had taken, many of the photographs I had taken in the prison study.
We didn't do any of the stuff as you see in Abu Ghraib, where they, you know, get into a big pile or something like that. But I certainly subjected them to all kinds of humiliations. I don't know where I would have stopped myself. Given enough time, we could have got there.
When the images of the abuse and torture at Abu Ghraib were revealed, immediately the military went on the defensive, saying, "It's a few bad apples." When we see somebody doing bad things, we assume they're bad people to begin with. But what we know in our study is there are a set of social psychological variables that can make ordinary people do things they never could imagine doing.
At Abu Ghraib, ordinary people perpetrated extraordinary abuses. To understand why, it helps to reach back to the lessons of Zimbardo's experiment, how people respond to a cruel environment without clear rules.
Everybody out.
We frankly didn't anticipate what was going to happen. And we tried to really test the power of the environment to change and transform otherwise normal people, much as Milgram had changed or transformed otherwise normal people in an obedience situation.
We picked 24 who were the most normal and most healthy. Half are going to be guards, half are going to be prisoners. And it's like flipping a coin, and heads, this one's a guard, this one's a prisoner. So at the beginning, there's no difference in the kinds of people who are in your two groups. On the first day, I said, this is not going to work. I mean, the guards felt awkward giving orders, and they'd say, okay, line up, repeat your numbers, and the prisoners start giggling.
I don't want anybody laughing. 3, 2, 1.
And then a very interesting thing happened. Dave Eshelman, who the prisoner's named John Wayne, like he's a Wild West cowboy, he begins to be more extreme.
It was a real laboratory for Zimbardo and I to watch human nature transformed in a very rapid way in the face of a very powerful situation.
Every hour, every day, there's a teeny little bit more of an increment. And they're stepping up, taunting the prisoners. They're stepping up, the count's not letting them sleep. They're stepping up. I don't think from one minute to the next, the people who are in it see the change and see the difference.
And then the next key thing happened beside the rebellion. Prisoner 8612, he was the first one to have an emotional breakdown.
At the time, if you had questioned me about the effect I was having, I would say, well, you know, they must be a wimp. They're weak or they're faking. Because I wouldn't have believed that what I was doing could actually cause somebody to have a nervous breakdown. It was just us sort of getting our jollies with it. You know, let's be like puppeteers here. Let's make these people do things.
The guards now began to escalate their use of power. Some of them had prisons clean out toilet bowls with their bare hands. They now taunt, humiliate, degrade the prisoners in front of each other, and they exert arbitrary control over the prisoners.
They keep thinking of more and more unusual things to do. And very soon after the fourth day, things begin to turn sexual.
So they certainly knew that the prisoners who were being mistreated had done nothing wrong to deserve the mistreatment. And yet the roles themselves were so powerful and the environment itself was so powerful that they ended up punishing those prisoners as though they had done something wrong.
And at the time I went along with it, I'm thinking, what does this matter? We don't believe this, but we can go along and chant it.
Nobody who was in that study could deny that the prisoner breakdowns were genuine. They were scary to see. They were upsetting to us. They were unexpected, but they were very clearly the real thing. At some level, we understood that something was happening that we were no longer in control of. It was damaging people. We didn't quite have a grasp on what to do about it. One of the mistakes we made was that we hadn't built in time to step back and to look at what was happening and call it what it was, which was mistreatment.
According to this worldview, the behavior of organisms, including human beings, is predictable and therefore controllable. In 1920, at Johns Hopkins University, Watson experimented on several babies ranging in age from 3 months to a year. The experiments were remarkable in their simplicity. He would present a candle to infants to see if they were afraid of fire. He would introduce animals to their environment to see if the children were afraid of them naturally, or only after a traumatic experience. He would make a hissing noise and observe the results. Watson learned that newborn babies had no fear of the dark. He also learned, however, that such fear could be conditioned. And so it was with rabbits. This baby, known as Little Albert, initially found delight in touching a rabbit. Yet, as Watson began to clang a steel rod and claw a hammer behind the child's head whenever he touched the creature, the reaction became not one of delight, but terror. Soon, the mere sight of the rabbit would elicit fear, even when no noise was provided, a fear that also extended to objects and textures of a similar type. From his experiments, Watson reached a radical conclusion which would come to define political and social engineering in the 20th century. The driving force in society, he claimed, is not love, but fear.
The science of behavior is based on the principles of operant conditionings. These principles and their practice have recently become known as behavior modification, sacrilege to some because it has to do with methods by which man can shape the behavior of others. But far from being a scheme to control people without their knowledge, it allows man to study and analyze behavior and to apply its healing potential to such fields as education, medicine, and psychology.
In behaviorism, there's the whole idea of behavior modification, where you can use various kinds of techniques to modify people's behaviors so that they stop doing what you don't want them to do and they start doing what you want them to do. So I think it's the scientific aspect of it and the controlling aspect of it that defines behaviorism.
John Watson was an extremely interesting character in the history of American social science and also the history of American advertising, which is a not insignificant connection between the two. His dissertation in 1906 was about the kinesthetics of the rat as it navigated a maze, and his idea was that he could remove one by one the senses of a rat, like remove its ability to see, remove its ability to hear, its ability to feel, and then see whether the rat could still make its way through a maze that it had been trained to navigate. So in his mind, rats were always stand-ins for human beings and human subjects. He called it psychology as the behaviorist views it, and it was basically his manifesto for behaviorism. And in it, he declared that behaviorism was a science of human behavior and that there was a method available to make a technology by which human beings could be shaped in any way that a scientist desired. Watson always was interested in control. One finds this theme throughout his work. He said, "Give me a baby and I can make any kind of man."
Frustration aggression is one of the most effective ways of managing a population. By directing a person's rage against selected minorities or outside enemies, the true cause of an individual's frustration can be effectively diverted. Yet in many ways, the theory is a symptom of something deeper. In order to engender real hatred against a particular group, that group must first be feared. And it is in the realm of fear that behaviorism made its most disturbing contribution.
Hobart Maurer, he would be called a neo-behaviorist, and he trained at the Yale Institute of Human Behavior. And he was quite unusual. I think his background was unusual, and he was also an unusually perceptive and sensitive man. And one of the first and most significant experiments he did was called a preparatory set, in which he had a human being lie down, or usually it was a student, lie down and be attached to electrodes that would deliver a shock whenever a light went on. And then so he would shine the light and then shock the student. And at that point, several people elected to discontinue the experiment. But those who persisted, he would then vary the experiment by showing the light and then not shocking them, or showing the light and shocking them. He would sort of make it unpredictable. And he discovered that people's state of anxiety and fear actually increased when the shock didn't come, when they were just waiting for a shock to come, or when they didn't know if a shock would ever come. And he said it actually created an atmosphere of pervasive fear and anxiety, and he even called it dread or terror. That atmosphere could be ratcheted up progressively the more the experiment continued and the more unpredictable the shocks were, so that after a while, when the shock came, the pain actually was experienced as relief and almost pleasure by the subject. He called it a nervous breakdown, or what he described in another part of the article as the ultimate demoralization of behavior. What he extracted from this experiment was the idea that there was such a thing as a coercive stimulus that could actually be used to create an environment of dread or terror or anxiety from a low to a high level, and that the scientists could actually, it was almost as if they were turning the volume on a stereo, they could decide how much of that atmosphere, how intense they would like it to be.
Needless to say, a creature in a highly fearful environment will be eager to escape to a new environment. This includes human beings. Maurer suggested that new behavior patterns could be quickly created through his techniques. The prospect of creating new behavior patterns quickly and efficiently became an obsession during the Cold War, when the Central Intelligence Agency assumed dominance in the field of mind control experimentation. During the Cold War, the national security state would take the logic of power to its logical conclusion. Known under the umbrella name MK-Ultra, mind control experimentation by the CIA would abandon any pretense to morality, leading to a nightmarish search for the holy grail of social engineering, a fully controlled, fully obedient human being. The majority of media on the subject of Project Paperclip has centered on German rocket scientists recruited by the United States to prevent the Soviet Union from establishing military supremacy. Seldom discussed with equal candor is the recruitment of Nazi scientists who specialized in human experimentation. Among them were Kurt Blom, who tested sarin nerve gas on prisoners at Auschwitz, and Hermann Becker Freising, who conducted fatal experiments at Dachau.
The American people got hold of X number of German scientists, but they immediately ran into a problem. Many of these scientists were classified as war criminals because of their activities during the war, and therefore were not eligible for State Department visas and could not be brought into the United States. So what the CIA did was create several of these different programs, including Paperclip, and their purpose was to, number one, recruit these scientists, and then number two, bring them into the U.S. while routing them around the State Department visa requirements. A well-known doctor who came in under Paperclip was Dr. Albertus Strughold, who did experiments during the Second World War that were full Nazi atrocity-type experiments. For instance, they were interested in the effects of high altitude on human beings, so they built a special chamber. They would put a gypsy or homosexual or a Jew or whoever it might be into the chamber and suddenly drop the pressure down to the equivalent of 60,000 feet. This obviously was excruciating and caused the person to die. And then they would take the guy out of the chamber, dunk his head underwater, and cut his skull open underwater to see if there was air bubbles coming out of the arteries in his brain. At the end of the war, the OSS was disbanded, and the same personnel really came together and formed the CIA in 1947. And the first documented CIA mind control programs are Bluebird and Artichoke. Artichoke and Bluebird started in 1950, ran into the mid-50s, and kind of overlapped with and were rolled into MK-Ultra, which ran till 1963. MK-Ultra, in turn, was rolled over into MK-Search, which ran to the early 70s.
Of particular interest were Nazi research papers by Dr. Kurt Plotner from Dachau concentration camp. Plotner had found that prisoners, when given high doses of mescaline, openly expressed hatred of their captors while also exhibiting an increased willingness to speak frankly about their own lives.
The dream of MK-Ultra was to come up with drugs that on the one hand would be sort of an ultimate truth serum, that you could give it to a person and they would tell you the truth about anything that you wanted to hear. And then on the other hand, there would also be some way to wipe a person's mind clean.
Heading up the CIA psychochemical experiments would be Sidney Gottlieb. A 1953 memo from Gottlieb states that MK-Ultra Subproject 6 is designed to develop a reliable source of lysergic acid derivatives within the U.S. The problem of supply was solved in October 1954 when Eli Lilly and Company, now known for manufacturing Prozac, succeeded in synthesizing LSD. As with the behaviorists, they started with animals. Here, we see millions of years of evolution turned upside down when a cat is given LSD. Soldiers came next. One of the first major studies was conducted at the Edgewood Chemical Facility in Maryland, where approximately 7,000 U.S. soldiers served as unwitting guinea pigs. They were given drugs such as LSD, mescaline, BZ, and PCP, then instructed to perform various tasks. Looking back at early behaviorist experiments, the analogies were obvious. Under the CIA and the Pentagon, what was good enough for rats was good enough for the U.S. Armed Forces. More than 1,000 of the soldiers emerged with mental health problems. Some attempted suicide. No compensation was offered. In a later experiment, and with the full approval of the National Institute of Health, Gottlieb arranged funding for a project at the Addiction Research Center in Lexington. Heroin addicts, mainly young black men, were kept on LSD for an incredible 77 days, a feat described by the center's director, Harris Isbell, as the most amazing demonstration of drug tolerance I have ever seen.
These are home movies taken in the 1950s at a European camp of the Children's International Summer Village, a program designed to bring together children from around the world for a better understanding of one another. NBC News has learned that the CIA was studying these youngsters, some as young as 11, as possible future recruits. According to CIA documents we have examined, this was sub-project 103 of the agency's top-secret MK-Ultra program. San Antonio, Texas. NBC News has also learned that the CIA paid for a study of adolescents here and in two other Texas cities, Austin and El Paso, in 1958 and 1959. It was a study of how youngsters behave without adult supervision. This study, MK-Ultra Subproject 102, refers to data being collected on 462 subjects in seven secondary schools.
The use of children in barbaric mind control experiments shows an evolution from the early behaviorists to the CIA mind doctors. In his 1973 State of the State message, then-Governor of California, Ronald Reagan, announced plans for the establishment of a biomedical facility at Vacaville. It would be called the Center for the Study of the Reduction of Violence and would use techniques pioneered by Jose Delgado. Delgado had gained worldwide fame for stopping a charging bull in its tracks by using a gadget he called a stimulceiver, a remote-controlled device that triggered electric impulses in the animal's brain.
Recently released CIA documents refer to the feasibility of remote control of animals and that special investigations will be conducted toward the application of selected elements of these techniques to man.
In Delgado's papers, he's basically implanting electrodes in the brains of human beings and experimental animals. In one of these papers, he refers to the animals as mechanical toys. In the Harvard team, there's pictures of a 16-year-old girl. In one picture, she's staring off into nowhere with a bland, empty expression on her face. In another picture, she's strumming on her guitar. In another picture, she's furiously pounding on the wall, all totally controlled by which button is pushed in the neurotransmitter box.
For prison officials at Vacaville, the idea of controlling inmates through remote control was a tempting prospect. West's proposal recommended psychosurgery as a tool for controlling prison populations and crime. Remarkably, he also recommended using schools in Chicano and African-American neighborhoods to screen for possible, quote, genetic defects. West's research would lead to new dreams of what he called the psychophysiology of conditioning. West noticed that DDD bore an interesting resemblance to post-lobotomy syndrome, as well as altered states of consciousness produced by certain drugs, hypnosis, and mental diseases like schizophrenia. In all of these cases, the notion of self, of free will, is displaced by something more obscure. In West's words, the patient loses all recollection of the fact that he formerly possessed a space-time image which served to explain the events of the day to him. With these ideas in mind, large funds were poured into the Allen Memorial Institute in Montreal, headed by Scottish-born psychiatrist Ewan Cameron. A future president of the World Psychiatric Association, Cameron set out to actualize the new vision of total control. He would create real-life blank slates out of his patients by wiping their minds clean and destroying their very notions of self. From there, new behavior patterns could conceivably be built upon the wreckage of their former identities. Therapeutically speaking, the experiments of the MK-Ultra psychiatrists were a complete failure. Yet, they were useful in at least one respect. The manual is called Kubark. Dated 1963, it is a how-to guide compiled by the CIA for interrogating suspects. In other words, a torture manual. Referring explicitly to early behaviorist experiments, as well as Cameron's studies at McGill, it describes a phenomenon whereby the deprivation of stimuli induces regression by depriving the subject's mind of contact with an outer world and thus forcing it upon itself. As the interrogate slips back from maturity toward a more infantile state, his learned or structured personality traits fall away. Exotic mind control techniques would not be required for the ultimate goal of controlling the opinions and behavior of the American public. The answer would come in the form of a small, flickering box. The behaviorist Ivan Pavlov was the first scientist to explain why moving images are so attractive to human beings. We instinctively react to any sudden or novel visual stimuli because of our biological orienting system. In evolutionary terms, this was and is necessary both for exploration of our environment and for defense against potential predators. Television not only entertains the mind, it relaxes the body. This has been confirmed by EEG readings of viewers' brainwaves as they watch television programs and advertising. In the hands of skilled media professionals, moving images create an effect roughly akin to hypnosis, producing passivity, a lowered level of alertness, and increased suggestibility. Television programming would increasingly resemble an experiment in fear-based conditioning applied on a global scale. The thesis of John B. Watson that fear, not love, is the guiding force in human society would no longer be confined to the realm of theory. Thank you.
program, Human Machines, WGXC. Listen on Saturday mornings to subsequent episodes, where we continue our conversation on the nature of being in an age of human-machine evolution.